The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Larkin, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Louise Dovery Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is May 5th, 2021. We have two matters on the calendar for oral argument this morning. The first is the case of Minigan Justin Charette, also known as Justin Marshall Crit, versus the state of Minnesota. Counsel, I know you are both familiar with our proceedings, and they are the same even though we are proceeding by Zoom today. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. I think you've also been told more than once that it's important to stay muted when you are not addressing the court, so we minimize feedback. And if anybody has problems hearing or seeing, please raise your hand or otherwise notify the panel. So with that, counsel for appellant, Mr. Erickson, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the appellant this morning, Justin Crit. Mr. Crit is requesting that this court reverse the post-conviction court's order, reverse his convictions, and remand for a new trial because the district court committed reversible error by denying both his motion to suppress and his motion to strike a biased juror for cause. I would like to start this morning by discussing the suppression issue. On June 28th, 2016, Moorhead police detained Mr. Crit, placed him in handcuffs, placed him in a squad car, and drove him to a police station to question him related to Ms. Wilcoxon's death and the fire at the house. As the officers brought him into the interview room in handcuffs, Mr. Crit looked directly at the officer and calmly stated, "Where is my attorney? I'm dumbing up." Then, a few minutes later, and immediately after police confirmed that he was being detained, Mr. Crit again stated to the officer, "Then where is my attorney?" The only way to interpret Mr. Crit's statements is to conclude that they were requests to be for counsel to be present for any questioning by law enforcement. In other words,
but Mr. Erickson, I mean, you would agree with me. I mean, that right to pretrial counsel only attaches when you have somebody subject to custodial interrogation, correct? I mean, that is the rule.
I disagree, Your Honor. Everyone has the right to invoke the right to counsel at any point. That has nothing to do with whether you are being interrogated or not. Sitting here right now, if a police officer knocked on my door and wanted to discuss something with me, I could tell the officer, no, I would like an attorney present for any further discussion. And I
but
have
Mr.
that
Erickson,
right.
But Mr. Erickson, that presupposes that the police want to talk to you. If they don't want to talk to you about anything, then what does it matter? You're invoking something that has no relevance.
Well, Your Honor, the facts of this case are clear that Mr. Crit was brought into the interview room to be interviewed by police. And because he was in handcuffs and he had been detained and brought in there, he has the right at that point in anticipation of any future interrogation to request that counsel's present. The only purpose of Miranda is to remind a defendant that he has that right. Excuse me.
Well, but it seems to me I'm looking at the case that you submitted by way of supplemental authority, and it cites to the bright line test in Edwards versus Arizona. And, you know, that test is all about someone who expresses a desire to deal with the police only through counsel. When they have made that expression, they are not subject to further interrogation. I mean, the rule is premised on not just custody, which I think I agree with you that Mr. Crit was in custody, albeit I think on the suspicion of a burglary in North Dakota, but he was in custody. But as I listened to I watched the video, it doesn't seem like anybody had asked him anything, particularly not about the offense in Moorhead. Why is Miranda even implicated? Why does he have a right to a lawyer at that point?
Well, again, Your Honor, this is the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. So the Sixth Amendment at this point isn't applicable. It's the Fifth Amendment. And there's no requirement that there's any questioning. It's only that he articulates a desire to have an attorney present. That's the standard. Ortega talks about this. Miranda says that at any point you can invoke your right to counsel. It doesn't, if we take a step back, I think sometimes I do this a lot where I get kind of trapped in these factors and these tests. What are we talking about here? We are talking about the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. We all have that right. Why would police need to start asking questions for a defendant to say, stop, I don't want to talk, or I want an attorney present? A defendant can anticipate that ahead of time and say, look, I'm in the interview room now. I want my attorney present because I don't want to talk to you. I mean, the fact that he hadn't been asked a question, that's not what triggers the right to an attorney. What triggers the right to an attorney and protection against self-incrimination is just the Fifth Amendment itself. And I think this happens all the time, right? I have clients who are arrested, and the first thing they say is, I don't want to talk to you. I want an attorney present. At that point, there hasn't been any questioning. We see that all the time, whether it's when they're first handcuffed on the street or put in the squad car or brought to the interview room. You can invoke that right at any time. So there's no requirement that he be questioned first. And I think the record's clear in this case that, well, first I'd like to back up. Judge Bjorkman, you mentioned that he was detained for the Fargo offense. While it's true that there was an issue with an offense in Fargo, the record is crystal clear that the detectives detained him specifically to ask him questions about this case. It was the Moorhead police.
But they didn't ask him. I mean, I'm still having a hard time with what the Miranda violation is argued here, correct? No.
It's not a Miranda violation. We're not arguing that there should have been a Miranda warning. We're arguing that he invoked his right to counsel. It has never been our position that they should have given him a Miranda warning at that time. Our position is that he invoked the right to counsel on June 28th, and therefore, under Edwards, on June 29th, the police could not initiate contact with him without first providing him an attorney. So we're not counsel? Arguing that there needed to be a Miranda warning.
Could you clarify for me, are you arguing a violation of the recognized Fifth Amendment to counsel or Sixth Amendment to counsel?
Fifth Amendment, Your Honor.
But isn't the Fifth Amendment to counsel triggered only under the circumstances where Miranda warning is required, which is in custody interrogation? So we may not be talking about whether or not there should have been a Miranda warning, but the circumstances that require a Miranda warning are those that give rise to the so-called Fifth Amendment right to counsel. Am I misunderstanding the law there?
Well, I don't think you're misunderstanding the law. I think this case is unique in that he initiated his Fifth Amendment right to counsel
before questioning. That's your argument.
And by doing that, because a reasonable police officer would know at the time that he invoked his right to counsel, police could not question him until an attorney was present. And that's
what
the Fifth
Amendment
protects.
Would a reasonable police officer know that if the invocation was not in the context of interrogation?
Well, the question is absolutely. I mean, so let's look at what happened in this case. He walked into the interview to be interviewed. That record is clear that was their intention. He said, where's my attorney? I'm dumbing up. At that point, the police officer responded, you're not under arrest. So the police officer knew that he was asking for an attorney, but the police officer was instead trying to convince him that you don't need an attorney right now. You're not under arrest, which is wrong.
I'm dumbing up mean?
My interpretation is that it means that he does not want to talk. He's not speaking.
The phrase, I'm dumbing up, requires interpretation, which I think it does. I mean, he didn't say, I'm not talking, get me a lawyer. He said, where's my lawyer? I'm dumbing up. That seems to be somewhat equivocal, doesn't it? It could mean, I don't understand what's going on. I want my lawyer to explain things to me. As opposed to, I don't want to talk to you until I have a lawyer.
A few responses. First, the dumbing up part, it would have to do with him wanting to invoke his right to silence, which is not what our argument is here, is that he is invoking his right to an attorney by saying, where's my attorney? And I don't think there's any other reasonable interpretation of the statement, where's my attorney, than I am requesting an attorney. I can't think of another reason why he would say that or what an officer would think, especially since the officers responded, you're not under arrest, and then later responded, you haven't been questioned yet. The officer clearly knew that that's what he was requesting.
Go ahead, Judge Bergman.
Well, then it pulls me right back to the question of, he's not being interrogated, and how can he invoke a right that he doesn't have yet?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we always have that right. I have that right now. You have that right. The only thing Miranda does is Miranda explains and reminds people of that right, because the situation where they're in custody and being interrogated, that they may say something incriminating. That's the purpose of Miranda, is to remind a defendant of the right that they have against self-incrimination and the right that they have an attorney. Again, if a police officer went up to you and asked you questions or said, can we talk, or presented a situation where there might be questioning, you could say, I'm not going to talk to you until my attorney's present, and they would have to honor that right, even though there hasn't been any questioning, because we all inherently have that constitutional right at all times. Miranda is just a reminder of what that right is for defendants who are in particularly vulnerable situations.
Mr. Erickson, I want to go back to when you first started. You said you want to start with the suppression issue, and you quoted his statement of, quote, where's my attorney? I'm dumbing up. And it sounds to me like you're acknowledging that I'm dumbing up is not really clear. That statement is open to interpretation any number of ways. And it sounds like you're more reliant on where's my attorney. But they agreed they were not going to question him that night because he appeared to be under the influence of either drugs or alcohol or both. And he did not seem to really be very coherent. Given those circumstances, even the comment of where's my attorney, isn't that somewhat equivocal in terms of, is he asking for somebody, or is he saying, is there somebody here that shouldn't be here? I mean, even that seems like, given the circumstances, a less than clear statement, and at best equivocal.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think you have to watch the video and that first part. When he walks in, he looks at the police officer and he says, where's my attorney? I'm dumbing up. Literally speaking, of course, that's a question. If you want to, you know, where is my attorney? Where could he be right now? But that's not a reasonable conclusion to think that he's actually literally asking where specifically his attorney is. In that context, the totality of those circumstances, a reasonable police officer, as the officers did in this case, would understand that to be a request for an attorney. The fact that he may have been intoxicated, that cuts the other way, in that he would have to waive the right to an attorney or waive the right against self-incrimination. We would actually ask him more questions, right? And in this case, even though he may have been intoxicated, it is crystal clear what he is saying. He's not mumbling his words. He is very articulate when he makes that statement. It was a difficult situation as it progressed, but at the time where he first asked for an attorney, he was very articulate and deliberate as to what he wanted, and the officer heard him and responded directly to that statement. So while it is true that he may have been under the influence of something, at that point, there was no question that he was asking for an attorney to be present for any future questioning. Your Honor, and again, the second part of this analysis is then, because he invoked that right, the police could not initiate any future contact with him. And by going to his cell the next day without him first initiating contact with police, and the record is clear, the detective admitted that he did not provide him with an attorney or a phone call to an attorney. They went and they got him and they brought him back for the interrogation. So under Edwards...
Okay, and it's fair to say, as I understand the record, there had been no interrogation up until the point where they brought him the following afternoon back into an interview room, read the Miranda rights, and then the interrogation began, correct?
That's correct. Yep, that's correct. After he initially invoked his right to counsel, there was issues in the interview room.
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt you just because I think we're clear on what those facts are.
Yep.
Is the issue of whether or not invocation of counsel was equivocal issue of fact?
That whether there was an invocation of the right, that's a legal question.
Okay, but whether or not it was equivocal, because it doesn't it have to be an unequivocal invocation of the right to counsel?
That's correct. It has to be an unequivocal.
And is that determination a factual one?
That's a legal question of whether or not there was an unequivocal invocation of right to counsel.
Okay, so we review that de novo.
That's correct.
And the district court didn't make that determination.
The district court found that he did not invoke the right to counsel.
Okay, he did.
The post-conviction court, on multiple occasions throughout its order, stated that he requested counsel, but then erroneously said that it wasn't a proper invocation because he wasn't asked questions first and that he was there for the Fargo incident. And those were all misapplications of the law. So that would be an
abuse of discretion. So your argument would be if they arrest somebody, they bring the person into an interview room, and the person says, I am not going to talk to you or answer any questions about anything without a lawyer. That person has put the police on notice of his intent to exercise his Fifth Amendment right to counsel. And until such time as he tells the police he wants to speak with them, they can't return to talk with him about anything.
That's absolutely right. Yep. Under Edwards, that's the law that the United States Supreme Court has articulated.
So long as it's an unequivocal request for counsel.
Yeah, because...
And what I just described would clearly be unequivocal.
That's correct. And that in this context, I believe it has to be unequivocal. Although in Minnesota, equivocal statements would then have to be... there'd have to be the stop and clarify. But because here they didn't ask him any more questions and they Mirandized him the next day, it seems that it would have to be an unequivocal statement, even though under Minnesota law, any equivocal statement, they'd have to stop and clarify, if that makes sense.
Okay. Thank you.
So I can respond after the state's argument and my rebuttal.
Right. Thank you, counsel.
Thanks.
Mr. Melton, argument on behalf of the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Brian Melton on behalf of the respondent, state of Minnesota. Your Honors, I think maybe to start off with, I think it is worth saying that the police officers involved in this matter, the detectives that did the interviewing of Mr. Critt, did everything right as far as protecting Mr. Critt's rights and doing a proper interview. I think the court has to at least look at and acknowledge what this case is not. Regularly, we'd be sitting here talking about 14th Amendment questions of whether an appellant's statement was voluntarily given. In this case, the statement given by Mr. Critt was voluntarily given. Usually we're talking about issues of length of an interview, lack of adequacy of warnings, or whether an appellant needs, his needs were met or ignored. I was even looking at State v. Zabala, which I didn't cite. I just would put it out there, 787 Northwest 2nd, 177. That had an additional piece to it in Zabala where the person was intoxicated, had not had sleep. And that was the questions of whether or not it was a proper interview and whether the person's statements that were given were voluntary given. We don't have any of those questions here in this case. In this case, the appellant met all that criteria, but it was clear that he was intoxicated, that he was high on drugs, that he was irrational, belligerent, he was spitting at the detectives, and he couldn't be interviewed at the time when he came into the police department. And so they ensured his rights by not interviewing him. Oh, sorry, Judge, I see
that. Well, and Mr. Melton, you also agree that the record is undisputed that he made two references to an attorney during the 10 to 15 minutes that he was being detained on, I guess, June 28th. Why isn't that sufficient to invoke his right to a lawyer and prevent law enforcement from initiating any conversation with him thereafter?
Correct, Your Honor. He did make two statements or two references towards attorney. I look at that and both, I think, just as the detectives would not want to interview an intoxicated a person who's high on, I think probably meth, but a stimulant. Those statements that are made by Mr. Critt, by the appellant at the time, I would say one, are nonsensical. I think number one, I think as the court looks at it and he yells out, and if you look at what's going on there, while he's making that reference to an attorney, it's not his invocation of an unequivocal statement that he desires an attorney for any further interviews by the police or during a custodial interrogation, as the court has stated. It's during a whole soliloquy of him talking about his telephone at one point. He's asking for his phone over and over again. He's yelling about his phone. He's actually, I would say, even screaming at one point, belligerent, saying, I want my phone. And then he also says, where's my lawyer? I'm dummying up. Well, just as I think Judge Larkin stated, That is an equivocal statement right there in and of itself. It's nonsensical. It doesn't make sense as to what is actually happening there. He's not even making sense as he starts to make that reference. And so as I cited in my brief, Your Honors, and I would ask the court to look at it, I think the court has to balance Davis v. United States, that we cite in our brief, with State v. Risk, 598 Northwest 2nd 642, that cites to Edwards, and specifically points out, to invoke the right to counsel, a suspect must do more than make a reference to an attorney. Here we have a person who's high on drugs, is not making sense, and then says, "Where's my lawyer? I'm dumbing up." Then later, when he's in his handcuffs, he's trying to take his handcuffs off, he's moving his body around, and the police come in there again, and they actually restrain him or hold him down, and he says, you know, they say, "You're not under arrest, you know, we're detaining you." He's saying, "I'm detained," and he says, "Where's my lawyer?" And again, that's a reference to it. That's not an unequivocal statement or unambiguous statement that he wanted an attorney during any further questioning by the police. And so,
Mr. Milton?
Yes, Your Honor.
Sorry to interrupt. Is there any magic words that a suspect has to invoke in order to, or state in order to invoke
the right? Your Honor, that it has to be at least clear. I mean, maybe as Justice Larkin talked about, I mean, maybe not that unequivocal, but I think to be able to say, I mean, as we've talked about there at this point, I would submit to the court that he's not in custody. He was a person of interest. There's a dead person. There's an arson.
That's a separate issue, whether he's in custody or not. I'm just focused on the words that he's using, and I'm trying to understand if there's a particular phrase that needs to be made in order to protect their right against self-incrimination.
Your Honor, I don't know that there's a specific phrase, but I think it does have to be clear so the officers would know that this individual no longer expects or wants to or plans to speak to police officers beyond you know, what he's already submitted to. He's there now, and he does not want to talk to them any further about, say, that case. I think what I cited to in McNeil versus Wisconsin, the right to counsel under the self-incrimination clause protects the suspect's desire to speak with police only through counsel. I do think that exists or can exist as long as that's clear, it's unequivocal, it's unambiguous, which we don't have here. I also think
I want to stop you right there because And I want to go back, actually. I have a couple of questions. One is the issue we discussed with the opposing counsel on whether this is a question of law or a question of fact. But let's assume for the sake of argument at this point that it's a question of fact of whether or not the statement had been equivocal or unequivocal. It seems that under these facts, the police officers clearly understood what he was saying by responding, saying, "Hey, you're not in custody. You're just being detained at this point, and you're not going to be interrogated." So it seems to me, under these particular facts, the police understood very, very clearly as to what he was saying, that by saying, you know, "Where's my attorney?" and "I'm dumbing up." In other words, "I want a lawyer, and I refuse to speak to you."
I think, Your Honor, when I look at it, I think it's more difficult. I can't agree with appellate's counsel when they say it's clear. That, I mean, you have a patrol officer that's walking in there trying to calm a highly irrational, highly upset drug-induced individual. They're telling them they can't have their phone. He's saying these words, and they're saying, "Well, we're not doing any questioning." Obviously, a police officer knows that there are requirements under a custodial interrogation, so he's placing that out there. But I don't think that makes the statement in of itself, just because he said it made a reference towards a lawyer and dummying up, that is a clear, unequivocal invocation of it. And I do think, Your Honor, I think one of the things that is mainly worth looking at and I think is important then is that even though there is no requirement to ask clarifying questions when it's ambiguous, like we have in this case, the case law, State v. Beckham, that we cite again, 354 Northwest 2nd 432, that the best way to clarify then, if there has been some ambiguous, because in this case, it's very possible that Detective Voxland, that did the questioning, doesn't even know that he's made these ambiguous statements. You know, I think that's one of the problems when we're talking about this whole thing. If somebody could have made a statement earlier, or even when he's out on the, when he first came to the scene and they took him into custody, they may not even know he said something. In this case, yes, it's recorded. Yes, he's in a room, but they're actually currently out doing other parts of the investigation. So they may not even know he's made.
Let me interrupt you so we can keep us focused on what we actually know instead of hypotheticals. So he was under the influence of some narcotic or something, or acting in that way when he made the statement, "Where's my lawyer? I'm dumbing up." What is the case law? And as I understand it, police are not to reapproach somebody who invokes their Fifth Amendment right to counsel unless it's merely to clarify. Can the police go back and clarify? And if so, does the fact that a person is under the influence of a substance when he makes a statement, does that allow the police to go back like 24 hours later when they think the person's no longer on the influence to clarify the statements they made while under the influence?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I did not find any specific case law. I think practically speaking, just as I talked about the idea that we wouldn't want them interviewing a person intoxicated, I didn't find a specific case that said when an appellant has made statements while under the influence, how much weight do they carry and can they then go back? But again, I just go back to State v. Beckman that does say what you should do, or the best way to clarify, is then to provide a full Miranda warning, which is what the police officers did in this case, that they have a sober person that slept for 20 plus hours. He's eaten. He is fully aware of his surroundings, and they now give him a full Miranda. And at that point, he chooses to speak to them. That clarifies any other ambiguity that's going on here, where we have an ambiguous, questionable reference to an attorney. And now they go through exactly with him what's required under Miranda, and then he chooses to speak with them. And so again, that's how it shows that they did protect all of his rights. And then I think even moving forward, after 35 minutes of him talking with the police department, he then does provide a full, unambiguous, unquestionable assertion of his Miranda rights or his right to counsel. And that's the first time he actually says, "I do not want to speak with you any further, and I want an attorney." And so I think, maybe to answer yours, Judge Reyes, I think when you hear that statement, when you see that statement, that is a statement that is unambiguous. But that is clearly the very first time that happens in this case.
Mr. Melton, I want to follow up on that point. In terms of let's assume for the sake of argument that the initial statement by him of "Where's my attorney? I'm dumbing up." Let's assume for the sake of argument that that is a proper invocation of his right to counsel and right to not say anything that would be incriminating. Is your position that the next day when they bring him back in and they Mirandize him, that cures the invocation of his right to an attorney?
I think, I mean, obviously I'm not arguing that way, but I understand your question. And I think that, yes, they would still be able to have the ability to at least clarify and understand now a person who's sober, who, I mean, they may not have, I mean, they're looking at that saying, "Well, he's said these words. We don't know what it means. And now we're clarifying." I think they have to have that ability. And so I think by giving a full, complete Miranda the proper way is the way to remedy that. Your Honors, I know only I would want to speak shortly. I have about 2 minutes left, and I don't know if the court wants any other questions answered in regard to the self-incrimination issue, but there was the second issue briefed and talked about in regard to a juror. We believe that juror was a proper juror. The juror, in the opinion of the state, was not a biased juror in the first place. I think the the questions that were asked of that juror, that individual made statements that I think any juror would make or question, you know, should a defendant testify? Should they not testify? How do you feel about it? And ultimately, and the trial court did find that there was a bias. The state argued against it. I know in my own brief, I even said I support everything that the court said. But in truth, we believe, I think that the appellate court here could find that no bias occurred. I think when the individual, the MK, talked through the statements or questions, they talked about that they would prefer to see the accused testify, but they ultimately said things such as that's ultimately his right. You would have to apply that. They were asked, you know, can you apply it correctly and apply the law correctly? And they ultimately said that they could. Several times over, they said it was the right of the defendant whether they chose to testify or not testify. And so I think that's important. I think ultimately the court said there was bias found, but ultimately that the juror was rehabilitated. I think that the trial court is in the best position to see that. The judge even talked about the body language and how they look presented. And that their statements were enough to rehabilitate them. And so I think that that's important piece too, that person, you know, would not be a cause for a mistrial. And so I just wanted to point that out as well.
So, counsel, could you clarify one thing for me? In district court, what was the basis for Fritz's motion to suppress his statement?
Initially?
Mm-hmm. Before the district court, not the post-conviction court.
Boy, I would have to, I may even have to depend on appellant counsel to look at that.
Okay. All right. I'm just wondering if he made the argument he's making now and that he made to the district court or the post-conviction court in the district court about this is about right to counsel as opposed to right to remain silent. And if you don't know, that's fine.
I wish I could answer that for you, and I could sure look that up, but I don't think I could answer that.
Maybe his attorney can. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Melton. Mr. Erickson, you will have the last word.
Thank you. If I could just respond to Judge Reyes's questions first regarding whether there's a magic word that needs to be said. The test is clear that it's just a reasonable police officer if they would believe that it was a request for counsel. So there's not any sort of magic words that need to be said. The question is, you know, if we're determining whether it's ambiguous or whether it's unequivocal, or sorry, if it's equivocal, is would a reasonable police officer believe that this was a request for counsel? Here, there's no other way to interpret his statement, "Where's my attorney?" than he wants an attorney there. So there doesn't have to be a magic words, but what he said was very clear. Second, as far as the standard of review, I know Judge Larkin was asking a couple of questions about that. Under Ortega, it's very clear that the facts, what was said, how it was said, those are reviewed for clear error, just like any factual determinations. But the application of the reasonable police officer standard is reviewed de novo. So that's what this court reviews, any sort of determination regarding the
implication. Could you clarify for me, was the argument that statement should be suppressed because there was invocation of right to counsel, was that argument made in the district court? Did the district court make any factual findings relevant to that argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The defense attorney made a couple arguments. One was that he invoked his right to counsel on June 28th, And the court specifically found in its order, I believe it's on page 6, that there was not an invocation of the right to counsel. So there were other arguments.
That's from the district court.
That's the district
trial.
Court.
Not
that's correct, Your Honor.
Post-conviction court. All right.
That's correct. Yeah.
And the district court found that he did not invoke his right to counsel?
That's correct. At the district court pre-trial, the court found that he did not invoke his right to counsel.
Okay. And then on post-conviction, the post-conviction court said he couldn't invoke his right to counsel. So that court didn't make any determination on whether or not he did invoke his right to counsel.
It's a little muddy, Your Honor. The post-conviction court said that he requested counsel probably 6 or 7 times throughout its order, but said that he couldn't invoke counsel because of the misapplication of the law regarding whether there was an interrogation or not, and then misapplied the Edwards rule about whether they could reinitiate the following day. So
Got it. It
seems like the post-conviction court agreed that there was a clear request for counsel, but said that somehow reached the conclusion that he couldn't request counsel at that point.
But the district court, who actually did the evidentiary hearing on this issue, found that he did not invoke his right to counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. The court made a brief finding at the beginning of its legal conclusions. The court found preliminary law enforcement's initial interaction I'm not sure exactly where it is. Sorry.
Here's what I'm thinking. Yep. It seems to me that the issue, there are a couple issues at play here. One, can you invoke your Fifth Amendment right to counsel prior to any questioning and have that invocation continue until such time as you're questioned? The other issue is, did you in fact unequivocally invoke your Fifth Amendment right to counsel? It seems to me that we had the district court saying he did not invoke his right to counsel. The post-conviction court saying, well, he did, but it doesn't matter because he couldn't invoke his right to counsel. So I think on the issue of whether or not he invoked the right to counsel, we would be bound by the district court's determination because there was no need for the post-conviction court to render any opinion or comments on whether or not he invoked his right to counsel if it was going to conclude as a matter of law that he could not do so and did not sort of analyze. It just made statements. I mean, it's almost like assuming he did, it doesn't matter. He can't invoke his right to counsel at that stage.
Yeah, I'd push back a little on that, Your Honor. Well, one is they'd both be reviewed de novo, so you're not bound by either of those legal conclusions. Second, the court doesn't give sort of a premise of even if in the post-conviction order. The court makes clear that Mr. Kritt requested counsel three or four times.
But I guess as you said, it doesn't matter because if, you know, what are the historical facts, that's reviewed for clear error and it doesn't seem to be any dispute about what the historical facts are. We've got it on tape. It's just as a matter of law, was this an unequivocal invocation of the right to counsel?
That's absolutely right.
And I think if the answer is no, that ends it. If the answer is yes, then it seems that we need to answer an issue of first impression, which is, does that unequivocal invocation of the right to counsel prior to any questioning have the same force and effect as it would if it had been made in the context of questioning? Is that a fair way to?
I think that's an excellent way to organize my argument.
I'm just trying to do it for myself.
No, the purpose of this is to make sure we're all on the same page, and it seems like we are. So with that, we believe that the district court and the post-conviction court erred by failing to suppress Mr. Kritt's statements, and we request this court reverse his convictions and remand for a trial, new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. That matter was well presented. We appreciate the care you've taken in preparing for and presenting our argument this morning. We will take the matter under advisement. And